Les colloques du Collège de France.
Okay, so I will first start by thanking my co-organizer for doing all the hard work, actually. And and so also I start, I'll paraphrase a bit Jim's introduction with some sort of similar slide, but I think now you've understand that the rate of development varies across species. Just for the anecdote, this is a picture I took while I was doing my actually postdoc in Nogent-sur-Marne with Nicole Ledorin. And that was the beginning of the RU 486, so we were starting to get a few human embryos from Bruno Peau, who was starting his group there. And so I had the chance to get a very nice specimen and could compare it next to the chicken embryo. And so indeed, what's quite remarkable here, it's the fact that you can achieve a very similar morphological structure in a timing which is surprisingly different, given that these two processes are taking place roughly at the same temperature. And so that's something I've been interested in for a long time. And so one of the questions, if you start thinking about developmental timing, is how do you measure developmental timing? And so you've seen already this slide from Mickey. And so what developmental biologists have done for many years is to establish the sort of classification of stages which reflect landmarks of development. So here for the mouse, these are the Tyler stages. For the human, these are the Carnegie stages. For chicken, that would be the Hamburger-Hamilton stages. And then try to align these different stages between species. But this is not a very precise way to do it because, in fact, because not all organs develop at the same pace in species. That's what is usually called a heterochrony, which makes it quite difficult to compare. So there is a need for a more precise or the neoteny we just heard from Pierre in the previous talk. So there is a need for a more precise way to measure time. And there is a classical way that embryologists have used for a long time in the vertebrate field as a ruler for time, which is to count the number of somites. So the somites, which are shown here in red, are these structures which correspond to epithelial spheres that are periodically distributed along the anterior-posterior axis. They will give rise to the axial skeleton and to the skeletal muscle, as well as to a few more derivatives. And they are formed from this tissue here, which is called the presomitic mesoderm, which exhibits the oscillation that we heard about, which itself derives from the early on the primitive streak and then the tail bud through the neuromesodermal precursors or NMPs. And so these somites, because of their regularity, have been used, as I said, to stage the embryos for a very long time. And so I'm showing you here an illustration of this in the chicken embryo. So here is a movie of the development of an embryo. You can see the rhythmic addition of somites, which proceeds in a sequential fashion, such that an embryo that has more somite is obviously older than one that has less. And in the chicken embryo, the somites form every 90 minutes, such that, as you can see here, you can get an idea of the real time that has elapsed between the formation of somites. And then you can reason, try to reason in absolute time using this this system. And an important aspect for our discussion is that the rhythm of somite formation scales with embryonic time, and you can play with temperature, for instance, to change the both the pace of embryonic time and the pace of somite formation, and this remains in synchrony, something which is a pretty fascinating property of developing embryos. And as we heard, it also it's quite different between species. So human embryos develop slowly, so they have a slower somitogenesis period compared to mouse or to zebrafish that or fish that have a very fast period and a very fast developmental time. So somites are added up to a significant number. So usually it's around 50 or 65 in mouse and up to several hundreds in some outsiders like snakes. But for a reasonable period of time, which is also corresponds to the phylotypic stage, you can use this as a measure of time in embryos. Of course, it's a relative measure because it depends on the species, but within that species, you can use absolute time. So, as I said, the somite is a rhythmic process, and so there's been a number of models trying to account for the rhythmic production of somites, starting with reaction diffusion models after Turing's work. But an important, very influential model at the time was proposed by Jonathan Cook, a developmental biologist, and Chris Zimmern, a mathematician. This is the so-called clock and wavefront model, which was based on the theory of catastrophes that was developed here by René Thom, with the idea that the formation of the somite was akin to one such mathematical catastrophe, like this is a cusp catastrophe, a bit akin to a bistable transition. And in order to make this catastrophe periodic, as is seen in the somites, they postulated the existence of an oscillator, which in the model is essentially an ad hoc addition. There's no specific mathematical rationale beyond making the catastrophic periodic for the addition of the oscillator. And of course, there is a second system which is called the wavefront, which essentially controls the displacement of the oscillator in space and ensures that the oscillations occur in domains that are progressively more posterior in order to make the periodic series and convert the temporal periodicity of the oscillator into the spatial periodic organization of the somites. And 20 years after this, we, with Isabel Palmerim, who was a PhD student in the lab, we found a class of genes that show such a rhythmic expression, identifying an oscillator, as was proposed in the Cook-Zeeman model. And so here is a chicken embryo showing a time window of 90 minutes, which is the time to form one somite. And these genes were expressed as a traveling wave, which is illustrated here in blue, and that you can see here by hybridization in situ, in this 15 somites, 16 somites, or 17 somites embryo. And you can see that these waves are reproduced each time a new somite form, thus demonstrating some sort of periodic process at the molecular level that anticipates the formation of the somites. And so work from many labs, including mine, have now shown that this oscillator is a gene regulatory network that involves three major signaling pathways, at least in mouse and humans, FGF, Notch, and Wnt. The so-called cyclic genes that show these traveling waves are mostly negative feedback inhibitors of this pathway, which led to some mathematical models involving transcription feedback loop with delays, as for instance for the HER genes, as Miki mentioned this morning, for the HES7 gene that is able to negatively regulate its own expression, as is probably acting as a pacemaker, at least for the Notch part of the oscillator. And there's been also the development of a number of systems to visualize these oscillations. You've seen already a few from Miki this morning. And this was initially pioneered by Ryo Kageyama in Japan, who developed luciferase-based reporter. And Alex Olela, when he was in the lab, developed a GFP-based reporter, which he introduced in a mouse embryo. And you can see with this reporter the traveling waves associated to the clock. You see that they sweep along the tissue each time a segment form, and they end up as a stripe that materializes the future boundaries of the somite. And so the clock is thought to define the rhythm of somite formation, the temporal component of the system. But as I said, you need a second component, a spacing component, which is called the wavefront, and which work from my lab also, but also from Takeda's lab in Japan and others, showed to be to involve a system of posterior gradients involving FGF and wind signaling. And the idea here is that this gradient establishes a threshold along the presomitic mesoderm that defines the level at which the cells can start to respond to the periodic signal of the clock. And here you see an illustration of this gradient with the FGF8 ligand, which shows this nice high posterior to low anterior distribution. This is phospho-ERK, which is a response to FGF signaling, and nuclear beta-catenin, which is also enriched in the posterior end of the embryo. So, interestingly, this gradient is established by an unusual system, not a classical source and sink system, but by an RNA decay mechanism whereby only the cells that are located in the tail bud in this NMP region transcribe the ligands for this, which are important for establishing this gradient, such as FGF8. And you can see this using intronic probes. You see that transcription is restricted to the tail bud here. And yet there is plenty of messenger RNA that you can see with this exonic probe in the tissue. And that's because the transcription is restricted here, and when the descendants of these NMPs exit into the presomitic mesoderm, they are loaded with mRNA, which starts to decay. And because the elongation continues, this establishes a gradient of messenger RNA along the tissue. And this is a fairly generic concept that you can apply to other ligands, like Wnt, and also to the proteins. But what is interesting here, and especially in the context of this meeting, I think, is that this is definitely a form of timer, because the decay of the FGF8 mRNA here is really going to control the position of this threshold, that is the time when the cells become competent to activate the segmentation program. So I just added this slide because I think it's interesting to contrast this to the clock systems and particularly the segmentation clock, which does not really specifies a periodic information. This is more of a timing information which is delivered here. And so this is a sort of dynamic view of the system. This is the posterior gradient of FGF and Wnt signaling. One of the advantages of this RNA decay system also is that it ensures the coordination between the posterior regression of the gradient and the maintenance of the position of this determination front along the tissue. And so when you combine the two elements of the system, what you have is pulses of signaling that are shown as these blue traveling waves along the tissue, and they can be read at the level of the determination front. So in the cells that passed this competence threshold, they become competent to respond to the clock signal, and they do so by activating so-called segmentation genes shown here in black, such as MES2. And so the idea is that this system is able to explain how you can specify rhythmic stripes of genetic information in such a sequential fashion. So, of course, this was all done in model organisms, mostly in chicken, mouse, and also zebrafish. And we were interested in trying to learn whether there would be also such a similar system operating in humans. This is clearly not possible to study it directly in embryos, or at least not to study the dynamic characteristics of the system, because in humans, so mitogenesis takes place very early, as you heard, between 3 and 4.5 weeks. So at a time when women usually don't even know they're pregnant, and there are very, very few embryos available at these stages. What we knew, though, is that through a number of classical linkage studies in patients from consanguineous families affected by this disorder called the congenital scoliosis, which means essentially a completely scrambled segmental organization of the vertebral column and the ribs, all the genes that were identified by this linkage analysis and which were giving a phenotype in as recessive mutants belonged to the segmentation clock. So these included genes like lunatic fringe, which is a notch modifier, delta 3, which is a notch ligand, HES7, that we heard about from Miki this morning, MES2, which is the response to the clock. So really suggesting that there was some sort of causal link between the clock system and human segmentation. So we spent quite a bit of time developing protocols to differentiate ES cells to the presomitic mesoderm fate, with a long-term goal to try to recapitulate these oscillations. So this was started it was even started by Jérôme Schall when we were at the Stowers Institute in Kansas City, but mostly developed when we were in Strasbourg at the IGBMC. And so Jérôme first developed protocols based on known developmental cues that are important for the presomitic mesoderm specification. So he developed the protocols for mouse ES cells and then transposed them to human ES cells. And so these cues are mostly a Wnt activator, Caron, and a BMP inhibitor. And with these two compounds in the medium, you can drive your human ES or iPS cells, which are at the epiblast, so that is at the pre-gastrulation stage. You can drive them within one day to become equivalent to neuromesodermal progenitors, so these tailbutt precursors. And within another day, they become essentially all presomitic mesoderm, so the posterior presomitic mesoderm, expressing markers like mesogenin 1. So we engineered reporters that express that have the venous fluorescent protein into the mesogenin 1 locus. And we see that up to 95% or so of the cells start to activate this gene, which is very specific for this green domain here. So very efficient protocol to differentiate these human cells to a state that appears similar to the posterior presomitic mesoderm. And so, of course, I have to, that's my legal UMAP. And and so what you see is that if you sequence cells at different days, 0, 1, 2, and 3, they organize into one single developmental trajectory. And if you look at the genes deployed during this trajectory, this is the pseudo time, they're all expected genes that are marker of the NMPs and then of the posterior presomitic mesoderm. And also you can note that the differentiation is very coordinated, very synchronized among the system. So that means that here we have an ideal system to study the differentiation of the presomitic mesoderm in humans. And then what Margarete Diaz-Quadros, who was a PhD student in the lab, did was to engineer a cyclic reporter, a bit like the one I showed you in mouse earlier on. But there she introduced a destabilized version of Achilles, which is a fast-folding, very bright GFP that was developed by Miyawaki in Japan. And so she introduced this construct following a 2A peptide at the end of the HES7 cyclic gene. And this was destabilized by PES sequence and other sequences. And then she differentiated these reporter cells to the presomitic mesoderm stage. And lo and behold, she was able to see that these cells not only had acquired a prismatic mesoderm identity, but were also able to recapitulate oscillations evoking the segmentation clock. And with this GFP-based system, what you can do is you can track the fluorescence in individual cells, and you see that the oscillations in single cells are tightly synchronized. And you can also, from this data, extract the period of the human segmentation clock, which is about 5 hours, which is, as you heard, about 2.5-3 times the period of mouse. And so, so this work, and also work from the group of Chanta Salef in Kyoto, and Miki, and from Jamie Thompson also in Wisconsin, identified for the first time the human segmentation clock and characterized this period. So then we started to think that we could use this system to study the control of the period of somitogenesis, and hence use this as a proxy for developmental timing. And as you heard, so the mouse development is much faster than human development, and scales by about a factor 2 to 3. And so what Margarete did is to compare first the differentiation of reporter lines that express the mesogenin 1 marker, which marks the onset of the posterior prismatic mesoderm fate. So she compared the kinetics of activating this gene in mouse and in human. And as you see, there is the expected scaling of about two times between mouse and human, and such that the cell starting from the epiblast stage activate this mesogenin, or acquire this posterior prismatic mesoderm state. And then what she did was to engineer the same reporter in the mouse line as she had generated in the human line. So she introduced S7, the Achilles construct, into the S7 in the locus in mouse. As you can see here, the fluorescence is much lower, so don't be misled. These are dying cells that are strongly labeled. The real labeling is lower, and this is because of the kinetics of the system. So here you have much more time to accumulate the GFP, and hence you get a much better signal compared to mouse. But you can nevertheless easily measure the oscillations using the mouse reporter line. And as you see, they're about 2 to 3 times as fast as the oscillations that are seen in the human cells. And I didn't put the slide, but the other thing that she noticed is that not only does the segmentation clock scale, but she also saw that the cell cycle is about twice as fast in these prismatic mesoderm cells compared to between mouse and human. So then we started to wonder about what could be causing such a difference. And as you already show, I think from James, it's known that in animals there is a global scaling between the gestation period and the body mass. So as we heard from Miki, the gestation period is not an absolute proxy for development. It's not a great measure because there's no real correlation between the stage at which embryos are born in different species and the true developmental stage. But nevertheless, it's true that there is a trend suggesting that smaller animals tend to have a shorter gestation period, and hence a shorter developmental period compared to large animals. And now there is also this famous Kleiber law, which says that the basal metabolic rate of animals scales with this exponent of 3/4 with their body mass. And so if you take these two observations that suggest that maybe there is some scaling between the gestation period and hence the developmental timing and the basal metabolic rate. And so this is what we decided to investigate. Here I want also to say a word of caution that these laws are not by any means absolute laws, and they suffer a lot of exceptions. And this might explain also some of the discrepancies that that we've seen between our data. So what Margarete started to do first was to measure compare the metabolic rate, the oxygen consumption rate between mouse and human, using a seahorse assay. So adding the same number of cells for mouse and for human, and she couldn't see any difference between the two species, both for the oxygen consumption rate and for the glycolytic proton excision rate. So we were really surprised and puzzled by this, but she realized that the human cells were much bigger, and hence it was not making sense to compare directly these rates without scaling by either the volume or the mass. And so then we teamed up with Timo Miettinen in the Scott Manalis lab, who developed a very sophisticated system to measure both the volume, the density, and the mass of individual cells. It's using a resonating cantilever where the cells in suspension modify the vibrating frequency of the cantilever, and from this they can extract properties such as the buoyancy of the cells and so on. And so from this, Timo was able to measure very precisely the volume of the cells in the two species, the mass, and then get the density. And so you see that the cells exhibit very similar densities. The mass is about twice as high for human cells, and the volume is also twice as high for human cells. So this, of course, meant that we had to normalize the seahorse data for metabolism. And when you do so, you normalize by mass. You see that the mouse cells' metabolism is twice as fast as the human cells. And that's also true for the glycolytic rate. So one simple way to explain this would be to imagine that there are more mitochondria in mouse, and that's actually the case. So if you label the cells with MitoTracker green and you compare the number, the intensity of fluorescence, you can get an idea of the density of mitochondria in the cells, and you see that this density is much higher in the mouse cells than it is in the human, always same type of scaling factor. I'm not showing you the data, but Margarete also showed that not only there are more mitochondria in mouse, but they're also more active than the human mitochondria. So this was suggesting that the mitochondria might be a central control for this process, or at least an important element of the control of the regulation of the period of the oscillations. And so she started to interfere with the electron transport chain, which is involved in the first in the oxidation of NADH, and then the transfer of electron to build this gradient of protons, which is then used by the ATP synthase to produce ATP. And so she treated cultures of reporter cells that exhibit the oscillating reporter, and she measured the impact of inhibiting either complex 1 with rotenone, antimycin is complex 3, and sodium azide for complex 4. She measured the impact on the period, and as you see, there is a significant impact of inhibiting these elements of the complex of the electron transport chain on the period of the oscillation. What was quite surprising in turn is that if you look at the effect of either oligomycin, which blocks the ATP synthase, or FCCP, which is an uncoupling agent which disrupts the proton gradient, you don't see an effect on the period. And this doesn't mean that these drugs have no effect. They have very serious effect on the cells. But if you measure on a reasonable time frames, because all these experiments are done with sublethal doses, you see that here there's no impact on the period, whereas this drug definitely slowed down the oscillations. So that was somehow suggesting that ATP production was not critical in the control of the timing aspect or the rate of the process, and suggesting that another very important aspect of the electron transport chain might be implicated, and this is the oxidation of NADH, which leads to the production of NAD+, which is a very important cofactor in many biosynthetic reactions and controls the redox status of the cells. So the NADH is mostly produced by the TCA cycle and the glycolysis, and it's oxidized at this level and delivers the electrons that will be transferred down the electron transfer chain to generate the gradient. So if NAD is important, then you might expect the NAD over NADH ratio to scale between mouse and human. And so for this, we teamed up with Owen Skinner in the Vamsi Muttaz lab. Vamsi is an expert on the mitochondrial physiology. And as a proxy for the NAD-NADH ratio, what people in the field are using is the lactate over pyruvate ratio in the extracellular medium, which is a proxy for this intracellular ratio. And so Owen measured this in the mouse and the human cells, and as you see here, he indeed saw that this ratio was twice higher in human cells, and because this is the invert to the NAD-NADH, that means that in reality, the NAD over NADH ratio is twice higher in mouse compared to human. So that was fitting with the idea that an important component of the system is this NAD over NADH ratio. And then what we wanted to see, of course, is so all that I've shown you so far is kind of loss of function experiments trying to decrease the pace of the oscillations. And of course, you can always argue that we're making the cells sick, and so we'd like to see a gain of function. We want to speed up the clock. And I'm not aware of any experiments in the literature that can really do this in any efficient way. The only example I know which is particularly striking is the snake, where we showed that the segmentation clock has a very significantly accelerated pace. But pharmacologically, it's not really been shown that you can accelerate the pace significantly. And so, again, we teamed up with Vamsi's lab, and they have characterized an enzyme called LBNOX, which is NADH oxidase from Lactobacillus brevis. And what it does is to oxidize NADH to NAD+, generating water. And so it bypasses entirely the electron transport chain, and thus it can act on the NAD-NADH ratio. So Margrethe cloned this enzyme in a lentivirus, and then she infected the presymptomatic mesoderm cells. And what she sees is, when you infect the cells, is an increase of the NAD over NADH ratio, and then a decrease of the segmentation clock period. And so it's not huge, but it's 15-20%, which is a very significant still decrease. And so, as I said, to me, it's the first clean pharmacological decrease of the segmentation clock pace that I'm aware of. And so, as we heard also, there's been other hypothesis for the control of the developmental pace that have been proposed through the nice work that you heard from James Briscoe and from Mickey Bisuya, who proposed that the control of gene expression was scaling between mouse and humans. So the work from Mickey's lab, but that includes the whole process, so that is the whole delay, transcription plus translation, or the work from James and also from Mickey showing the importance of the protein half-life in this process. So we decided to look at this because the redox status doesn't really tell you how this might control developmental speed. And so what Margarete did first is to measure the global proteasome activity, and she saw exactly what James and Miki had seen, that is, it's much higher in the mouse compared to human. But a bit to our surprise, what we found when treating with different proteasome inhibitors, like bortezomib or lactacystine, she couldn't see a significant effect on the oscillations, on the period of the oscillations. Yet, again, I want to emphasize that these drugs have a strong effect on the oscillations. They stop the oscillations quite rapidly. But at these doses, the first oscillations are maintained and they exhibit a normal period. So then we turn to the translation rate. And then Margarete used different techniques, like pure myosin incorporation, which leads to the formation of these pure myosinylated peptides that you can detect with an antibody. And then by fax, you can get an idea of the translation rate. And as you see, it's, again, we find this a significant difference between mouse and human, with the mouse being much higher than the human cells. And then she showed that by blocking translation using cyclooximate, which was something that Alexis Hubo in the lab had seen first in mouse, she could slow down the pace of the oscillations while maintaining the oscillations for a while. And this was dose dependent. So this was pointing us more in the direction of the translation. And then she further showed that when she treated with the inhibitors of the electron transport chain, as you can see here, that has a strong impact on the pure myosin incorporation, so it decreases the translation. And yet, when she treated with oligomycin, which has no impact on the period, she wasn't seeing this difference. So, and finally, the final experiment she did was to look at the incorporation of, look at pure myosin incorporation when she infected the cells with the Albenox construct to increase the NAD over NADH ratio. And as you see here, this does lead to an increase of the translation rate, consistent with what I showed you, that the acceleration of the segmentation clock that we see upon overexpression of Albenox, upon increasing the NAD-NADH ratio, also leads to an increase in translation, which is similar to what we've seen in the comparing mouse and human embryos. Yes, I'm done. So this is my final slide. So what we think is that the basal metabolic rate is an important component of the control of the developmental pace and the segmentation clock period, at least between mouse and human. I know that so Miki presented some differences, at least in other species, so I'm not claiming that this is a totally general rule. I'm surprised that it's not more general, but that's the way the data is. So that appears to act at the level of the electron transport chain and mitochondrial content. I think this really makes a lot of sense in the light of what we know from the literature, like, for instance, the control of the pace of both the clock and the developmental rate by temperature is much more easily explained by a control via such systems. So this acts on the redox balance, which controls the protein synthesis rate and eventually the clock rate. So you may wonder how this might work, but we haven't tested it yet. But one simple idea would be, because NAD+, for instance, is required for the synthesis of several amino acids, like aspartate, for instance, this might be a way to explain how this indirectly controls the protein synthesis rate. And there are many different ways you could explain this impact. And again, I want, because that might sound confusing to you, and I'm sure it is also a bit to us, but for instance, she looked at she also compared these properties between mouse and human cortical neuron precursors, so a different cell type from what James showed, and she didn't see the differences in size, but she still saw the difference in metabolism. So it's a complex picture. I think that's what we can say at this stage, and but it's very exciting, and I'm sure we'll eventually figure out how this all works. What I also want to emphasize is that this control of the developmental rate, as we heard a lot, is under genetic control because it's highly variable across species, and you can imagine many ways to play on this control. Just for instance, the control of the mitochondrial number, of their activity, or there are simple ways you could imagine that would regulate this. And so, and with this, I'm going to leave you. So this is Margrethe, who now started her own lab at MGH as a fellow. And she almost single-handedly did this work during her PhD. So thank you very much.
Retrouvez tous les contenus du Collège de France sur www.college-de-france.fr.